Hey everybody, what's up? It's me again, Shelby with Hooks, Books, and Crime. I'm loving my bangs today. What's up? Nah, I just really love my bangs. I've got my old, like, little kind of scene bangs going on with some edge to it. You can't see, but I've had an undercut for a long time. I have too much fucking hair, and it's fucking hot. It's summer, San Antonio, Texas, which means brutal. But I'm not seeing the weight gone from my face yet. But man, I am working out 5, 6 days a week, sometimes twice a day. I'm hardly eating, and I actually don't miss food. I'm lying. Sometimes I do. I miss like Gesell, but it's okay. I have it every once in a while, but I'm not overindulging in food anymore, which is nice. I know my lights are hanging, by the way. I see it. It's bothering me, so if it's bothering me, it might be bothering somebody else, so let's just get that out. Like, I see it. I know. I hate it. So today, I realized, like, it's really bare back there behind me. I'm going to. I'm actually working on making a cat pillow. I actually have a pattern from Pony McTate that I'm gonna be following. I'll post a link on the video. I'm just using a bunch of scrap, like Big Twist yarn, and I love this yarn. I bought colors for, certain things I was doing, making beanies. I made my son like a Beetlejuice inspired sweater, so I have these colors kind of left over that I don't know what else I'm gonna use them for. So I figured, why not backgrounds for my little cat pillow, just so I have something, and just so I can create stuff. I've made so much amigurumi. I think I said that right. I'm not going to focus on that word because I could sit here forever trying to pronounce it. I've made some clothes before, but I don't know. I want to try pillows, so we're doing that today. I'm still saying I'm going to try to cut down on the you-knows, but I don't. I'm in a great mood. I've just been really, really happy with like this journey I'm on, the dieting, the working out. I don't know, your girl's cooking. Your girl's cooking. I don't know if y'all caught my little red flag TikTok. It's not like I get a lot of views or anything, but I fucking loved doing that. So I'm gonna keep doing that like weekly and just putting assholes and shitty people on blast because why not? They did something horrible. The world should know. And when I say something horrible, I don't mean like they rear-ended someone and didn't want to pay for it. I think everybody has like a shitty moment and can have a bad attitude. But if you're murdering people, yeah, you deserve to be put out there. You just do. Okay, so now that I have my little rant, let's get going. I'm still on a high. That's the other thing I wanted to talk about. I am on a high. I went to see the Turnstile album played in the theater. So fucking cool. My God, I wish that was a thing when I was like really in the scene. Oh my God, that album is golden. I swear, it's so wonderful. It's amazing. My favorite album from them is still Time and Space, but yeah, this new one, Never Enough, and then Glow On. It's so good. It's really, really good. I'm on a high from it too. We're already making plans for when they come here, how we're gonna make it work with the babies so we can go fucking rage. It's gonna be awesome. Okay, now my rant is over. But okay. And again, this pattern's gonna be in there. I think I mentioned this in one of my videos. I'm gonna mention it again. I am not really like this extraordinary crocheter. I'm not. I'm just someone who really loves true crime and really loves to crochet. Okay? I wanted to get that out there too. Again, I don't have a lot of views, but by chance, if people are like, ooh, is she making? I'm not great at this. I just really enjoy doing it, and that's okay. Okay, so we're taking it back to the 90s, by the way. So it's May 13th, 1995, early morning hours in Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin. What an adorable name for something so heinous. Two men are driving down the road. I think they're putting out signs for their business. So, they're just looking for good spots to advertise themselves. And the passenger happens to see what he is sure is a dead body. They call the police, investigators go out, and what they found is very gruesome. They find a woman's body, she's nude, and she is horribly beaten, maliciously stabbed. Stabbed to the point where she's nearly decapitated. Her head is almost off. And she's strangled. Can you imagine that? Not only is like the neck nearly severed, where the neck comes together, you can see ligature marks. That is gruesome to the core. Awful. This woman went through something terrible. So they find this body. And what they also notice is there is no blood, really. The body's like drained of blood. There's no blood around her. So this murder happened somewhere else and the body was dumped here. Where the body is dumped had recently been dubbed the killing fields because they had actually, not too long before her body was found, they found three other bodies there. So police are already like, wait, do we have a serial killer or, you know, what's going on here? So, you know, I did it, you know. God damn it, Shelby. Get it together. Okay. So they don't recognize her, which I don't expect cops to recognize, you know, every body they find. They go ahead and, you know, medical examiner takes her in, the coroner. And they, while they're waiting for that, just going off of her face and everything, they don't recognize her. They're looking at like missing people's posters in the area, not reports. They're not finding anything on that either. So they're really having a hard time identifying this woman. So they dub her a Jane Doe in the meantime until they find out who she is. And while they're waiting again for the medical examiner to look into, you know, what actually killed this woman, things like that, they go ahead and, you know, it's all over the radio. But I mean, this gets to the point where they actually put a picture of her face on the news and hope to identify this woman. And this picture, it is just so heartbreaking. Oh my God. It's so heartbreaking. Her face is so swollen. And her eyes, both of her eyes are so black from the beating that she took. It's just repulsive, really, what this person did to her. It's terrible. This poor woman. What a poor baby. It's really heartbreaking. So they, even after putting her face on the news, they don't really have any luck. Once they get the fingerprints from the coroner or medical examiner, they go ahead and actually take this to the Illinois State Police facility in hope that maybe they'll have something on file for her because they're not too far apart. And it's 100 miles away. But Chicago or Illinois just has such a much larger population than Wisconsin. And because of Chicago, as well as some surrounding areas, you know, the Chicago suburbs, they're hoping that maybe they have an identification on her. And they do actually. This woman has actually been arrested before for nothing major. I think it was described as an obscure charge. So something I'm guessing minor and maybe not so common. And she is identified as 31-year-old Nanette Krenzel. And Nanette does live in the Chicago area. So, now that we have an identification on her, police start looking into where was Nanette that night? Where was she? Who was she with? They start looking into that night's background and start really getting their investigation going. What they find out is what they find out is, so Nanette has a boyfriend. She lives with her boyfriend. His name is Jacob or Jake Stutz. She lives with her boyfriend. She's a mother of two children. She does not have custody of her kids, but she's still very involved. It's not like she gave them to her ex and was just like, I don't want to deal with them. Nothing like that. She sees her girls. She likes to enjoy her time with them. She's definitely involved. And forgot to mention this, that Saturday that her body was found, that's the weekend of Mother's Day at that time. Mother's Day was May 14th, 1995 that year. Which her poor mother and those poor girls. Terrible. And like I said, just the brutality of it. The death is sad enough, and then the heinousness with it is just salt in the wound. Definitely. So they actually bring in Jake and his brother Joe, because the two are usually together. They bring them in for questioning, and they bring them in together to one, identify the body visually, and they also, I think they did it also to see how they react. Are you broken up over this? Are you very cold? Can you not look at her? They're looking for these kind of things. What they notice is Jake, when he identifies the body, when he sees her, he's very stoic. Not very much emotion. He's very quiet. His brother Joe, or Joseph, he's Joseph, but he goes by Joe. Joe, on the other hand, is visibly upset at the sight of her and what happened to her. He's having a hard time processing this. And that's noted. You know, the cops notice this, of course. They go ahead and ask Jake, you know, like, where were you that night? Where was Nanette that night? And what they learn is that night, Friday, May 12th, everybody in Chicago was out and about having a good time. It was the playoffs, the NBA playoffs for Chicago. If you know 95 very well, who was playing in 1995 for the Chicago Bulls? Michael Jordan. And that team was dominating everybody. That was the dream team. Well, the dream team was the US team, but a lot of them consisted of Chicago Bulls. I think Scottie Pippen was on there at one time, Dennis Rodman, maybe. I'm missing a player, but that was kind of like the prime time of NBA for a long time. So the whole city is out. It's game day, and everybody wants to see the game. Everybody wants to have a drink with a friend. And that's where you can find Jake and Joe. Jake and Joe are at their regular bar that they frequent called Fuller's. They're at Fuller's Bar, and at the time, they're actually accompanied by their father as well as Joe's girlfriend. Nanette shows up a little bit later, and Jake wasn't expecting her to be there. She shows up, possibly a little intoxicated herself. And they start arguing pretty quickly. Apparently, Nanette was quite a jealous woman when it came to Jake. She was very feisty. On one account, someone who knew her pretty closely said that she could be a lot to handle at times, to the point where her family kind of would separate themselves from her. I don't know if it's because they're embarrassed of how she acted, or maybe, you know, there's always that person who's kind of a liability after a while because they're so hot-headed and always ready to start some shit and always ready to throw something down. It's like, I can't have a good time because they constantly have to watch you before you start something. So we don't know if which is the case, but it seemed that she didn't have a very large circle because of maybe the way she reacted in situations and how she handled herself. But so they argue, they take the argument outside, I'm sure, because that's a disturbance for everybody else, especially when everybody's trying to watch a playoff game. And so they go outside. This argument ends with her basically breaking up with Jake, like, she's done, I'm over it. And they separate. Nanette goes back into Fuller's. Jake, pissed off, actually, he does go back into Fuller's, but he goes back in just to ask his brother Joe to move the car so Jay can go ahead and get out and go home. And he does. But because all he's saying is, you know, I went home after that, and we know Nanette fell to a very disturbing demise that night. Technically, he has no alibi, because we know Nanette stayed out later than that. So Joe says Nanette left later. That last he saw her, she went down an alleyway. But because Joe went home with his girlfriend, Joe has the alibi. He most definitely went home. He was not involved with Nanette. So the office, now see, I replaced Janelle with, so god damn it. I'm sorry. So Jake is clearly a prime suspect at this point. And they go ahead and search the apartment that him and Nanette shared. And they really don't find anything. They don't find any, you know, the apartment isn't unusually clean. There's no blood. There's nothing that could give the slightest idea that there was a disturbance or some type of altercation takes place. So because of that, and because there is nothing pointing to Jake other than that little hunch, they have to move on. They have no proof that it was Jake. And that seems to be kind of the problem with this whole thing. They don't have very many leads. They don't know what happened to her, and they can't really find anybody who knew where else she had been that night. And then, oops. So as the officers are going around asking different people, they ask one of her neighbors, and her neighbor tells them that at one point Nanette had got into it with some gang members. And officers go ahead and look into that for a split second. And really, that kind of goes nowhere either. They have no proof that this was gang affiliated, and also the manner of which that she died. Gang members, I mean, it's like three ways of killing someone. You have the multiple stabbings that would have killed someone already. You have the excess in stabbings. She was stabbed over 40 times. You have the strangulation, the ligature marks. And then you have that she was brutally beaten by a blunt object. That's a lot of work, and that's a lot of time for a gang to focus on a woman that was not a rival. She wasn't stepping on their turf. No shit like that. It's a lot of work for a gang when they could have just shot her and ran. So that's out too. They don't think that's what happened. After they roll out the gang members, they're next kind of, you know, trudging along, trying to find something. Then they get a tip that they need to look at Joe, Jake's brother, Joe Stutz. And as it is, when they interviewed Joe, he made it very clear he was not a fan of Nanette. He did not like her. Did not like her as a person. Really did not like her with his brother. He did not care for her. They kind of have nowhere to go with Joe. Other than him not liking her, there's nothing else there. It wasn't Joe. That's what they know. More than likely, Joe had nothing to do with this, and they still can't prove that Jake had anything to do with this. So it kind of becomes a cold case. They have nowhere to look, left or right. There's nothing pointing to another person. And again, she had a small circle, so there's not a lot of people that they can ask either. So that, you know, it's a tough one, and I'm sure for detectives, it's frustrating because you want to get someone who did something so heinous and disgusting. You really want to put that person away, and you can't find them. You have no sign and nothing to give you the slightest idea. Like, they're thinking out of the box, but there's nothing even telling them to get out of the box. And that's the hard part. So 7 months goes by. 7 months go by, and they're still stuck on where to look for the murderer of Nanette. And then December of 1995, a woman gets a call from her daughter who is in Paragould, Arkansas. And she sounds panicked, distraught, and she tells her mother, "We've abandoned the children. Michael murdered a woman. We can never come back to Chicago." And I mean, kudos to this mom. She went straight to the police after hanging up with her daughter. She went straight to the police and told them everything that her daughter had just told her. The police go ahead and take a trip down to Arkansas, and they go and visit. Her name is Donna Lee, married to Michael Lee. And they go ahead and question Donna. And she's, at first, she's a little reluctant. One of the officers even says that she was so scared and nervous that it almost as if she had battered wife syndrome. And eventually, though, they do get her to talk. And she says, because she did actually, the woman that she described that they murdered, she said, light skin, green eyes, dark hair. That's Nanette. That's Nanette. She tells them that what happened that night, Friday, May 12th, is Nanette showed up to the bar that her and Michael were at. So this is the bar that Nanette went to after leaving Fuller's, after she got in that argument with Jake. It's, you know, basically one of those things where it's like, I don't want to be here around people that know Jake, but I'm not ready to go home yet. So she goes to a different bar. At this bar, she meets Donna and Michael Lee. They hit it off. They're having a good time. And Nanette decides to go back home with them and, you know, kind of keep the party going. They keep drinking. She goes back to their place with them. And they're drinking, having a good time. But at some point, Donna kind of snaps. And she gets super pissed off, accuses Nanette of flirting with Michael, and is basically like, fuck this, I'm going to bed. Which I'm like, girl, if you were concerned that he's flirting with her, you're going to go to bed and leave him alone with her? Mm-mm. She can go. Where are you going? So, that's just me. And I know I'm not alone on that one. But, she goes to bed, passes out, and then she wakes up to a loud noise. She goes and checks what's going on. She finds Michael standing over Donna, and he just hit her with a bat. That's what she heard. She heard the bat hitting her head. That's what woke her up, which, ugh, what a horrible sound to wake up to. And what a horrible realization that that's what you heard and that's what woke you up. That is daunting. I could not imagine that. That's just so crazy to me. That's terrible. So, apparently, Michael, when Donna went to bed, Michael did make a move on Nanette, shocker. And apparently Nanette, like, did not reciprocate these feelings, which pissed him off. And then Michael snapped. And Michael just, I mean, fucking attacked her. Again, you know, she's been beaten. She's been stabbed. This poor woman's been, like, put through the ringer. He tells her, I need to get rid of this body. So she helps him roll the body up in a carpet. They put the body in the trunk and drive out to Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin. Again, 100 miles out from Chicago. And they dump her there to be found by those men the next morning. And after that, you know, they just pack up and flee. So Donna admits, tells them all of this. Donna tells them everything that happened that night. And that's when officers are like, okay, so They go to the apartment that Donna and Michael lived in together in Chicago, and they search there. Of course, it's been 7 months, so the apartment's been cleaned. It's been re-rented to someone. But what they do is they start cutting the carpet and pull it up, and they just find blood. They're able to take that blood as a sample and go to get it tested. And that's when they go and arrest both Donna and Michael Lee. Michael was actually arrested at work. So they go and arrest Michael. Michael asks for a lawyer pretty quickly. And as we true crime enthusiasts know, once a lawyer is requested, all questioning has to stop. They can't ask really anything else, that they're just stuck. Eventually, Michael does come around and he's basically like, look, he decides to speak with them again. They re-Mirandize him, they do all that stuff. And he basically admits that what his wife is saying is true, and he makes it very clear. Aside from disposing of the body, Donna had nothing else to do with this. This was all him. And he doesn't want her to be blamed for his actions. Which is like, oh, how noble of you, Michael. I'm glad you care about someone, asshole. He, tells them what happens, which basically matches everything Donna said. And yeah, that he disposed of her body and they fled. So after he has this admission, he's arrested, and eventually the DNA does come back matching. The DNA does come back matching the net. So that's kind of, just sealing that nail in the coffin for him. Even if he didn't want to confess, that's there. So prosecutors, everybody's getting ready to go to trial for this. Michael's on for first degree murder. But unfortunately, there's a problem. When they arrested Michael and told him, he requested a lawyer, they can't quite question him anymore. Some junior assistant or like stated assistant attorney, somebody basically made comments that could be seen as coercive, basically saying, well, if you want to, it would benefit you, or we're not pushing you, but you may. They did some shit like that, which could be considered coercion, which means his whole confession is out. They cannot use it anymore. Which, the prosecution's like, what the fuck? Like, really? I get why it's necessary, but it's frustrating, all that work, and I mean, all that waiting, especially. And you finally get, I mean, he hands it over to you. You just gotta use it. He did the work for you. And offer it to possibly just go away. You can't even use it. That's so frustrating and upsetting. But because the DNA came back matching Nanette, they still have, a smoking gun, most definitely. They still have it. However, this, because they cannot use the confession now, because they can't use the confession, they have to completely rely on Donna. And Donna did not want to testify against her husband Michael. She didn't want to do it. But she's actually subpoenaed for testimony, which, as we all know, if you're subpoenaed, you are legally bound to tell the truth and be fully honest of what happened. So they go to trial. Donna is, brought onto the stand, and her testimony is kind of what everybody's waiting for because of the lack of confession from Michael. She goes on, she starts telling the story, and then She drops a bombshell on everybody on the courtroom. She tells them that she was part of this too. There was no, I went to bed and then I woke up to the sound. She was there for all of it. She ends up testifying that her and Michael went out that night specifically looking for a woman to have sex with and to kill. That this isn't the first time they've done it, but that's what they were really out to do. And poor Nanette just happened to be who they caught. She tells them that she's the one who stabbed Nanette. It was her who did the stabbing, not Michael. Michael did the other things, but Nanette was most definitely a participant. She felt that Nanette was destined to come into their lives for this, which is just truly disgusting. Donna, bitch, you disturbed. Like, gross. And she, I mean, I could you imagine that courtroom? People were probably like gasping, pissed off. I don't know, like, that's insane. But what's weird is, so Donna makes this admission. It's not like, you know, like you see in the movies, you know, bailiff, take the witness into custody. It was nothing like that. Nope. They just still focused on Michael. And Michael, like, he does get found guilty. He gets sentenced to life with an additional 70 years because of the act and how gross it everything was. Michael gets life plus an additional 70 years. And unfortunately, the officers feel a victory and everything, but they can't arrest Donna. Donna just gets to live free with her fucked up head. Apparently, what you use in testimony cannot be used against you later, which is bizarre to me. Again, I get it, but really, in this case, not the wisest choice. And you know this bitch said this because she knew that I'll be all right. So, not wishing you the best, Donna, that's for damn sure. That's gross. But I'm hoping you have remorse, and I'm hoping you became a great person after, because, like, wow. Like, how do you sleep at night? Maybe she doesn't. But, yeah. There wasn't, I wouldn't say justice was completely served in this case, because Donna got to walk free. I didn't look into what Donna is up to these days. I don't give a shit. Fuck you, Donna, for doing something so deplorable. I am happy. Well, you know, I'm saying that, but maybe we just don't know it. As long as it's not like some Casey Anthony shit where she's on fucking TikTok all like, look at me, and everybody's just like, I hope you die, bitch. So I hope she's not trying to do anything like that, like trying to be like the rest of us, you know, those of us who don't kill. But yeah, Nanette's poor family has to go on knowing this, that only one of her killers had to, you know, is doing time, and the other one got to live her life. A life longer than Nanette got to live. And that's the tragedy there. Nanette's two girls, you know, they grew up. I'm sure it was hard for them. to not have a mother. Those girls were expecting to be picked up by their mom for Mother's Day, and she didn't show up. And, you know, it's even more heartbreaking because it's not that your mom didn't want to be there for you. Someone took her from you. They physically prevented her from being your mom. It's so fucking sad. So I wish her family the best. I wish her girls the best. That's the really sad story of Nanette Krenzel. Let's see here. I hope y'all enjoyed this story. I didn't get very far because I don't know if y'all could see. I was making a lot of errors. I got this far on my little granny square. But, sorry, my cat. I got that far. But yeah, I'm trying to make like this little granny square pillow. I actually really like granny squares. I'm not much of a fan of... Say hi. Hi. It's the weaving in ends that keeps me away from doing granny squares. I love them, but I'm not thrilled. I guess that's why a pillow I don't mind rather than a blanket. Because it's not as much weaving in as other things could be. So, that's good. I still have not figured out how to end these things because they're so fucking sad and tragic. But, I can hear my kids are losing their shit downstairs, probably because they're antsy to go swimming, which I am too. I need to get my exercise in. With that, I hope you have a great day. I hope you crochet your little heart out. Catch me on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. As well as you can find me on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And, you know, I wish y'all the best. Don't be shitty. Okay, bye.